Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week we're taking a sneak peek inside the working day of Lucy Whitehouse. Her brand new book, Critical Incidents, is out right now, and for her it's quite a momentous one, because in it she's made the shift from psychological crime to more procedural crime. So we'll talk about why that's such a big deal. Also, you can hear why she loves the buzz of women-only working spaces and why for her it's there that she needs to go to get her work done. And you can also hear why to start writing she needed just a little bit of free time and a little bit more booze.
I started writing because I was just fed up with my own prevarication. So I bought a bottle of dessert wine, locked myself in the garden and said, you can't come in until you have 3 pages. And they were terrible, but I didn't allow myself to stop until I'd written 30,000 words, because that felt like so much that it would be psychologically painful to put that in the bin. And that was a way to get myself over the hurdle of how do I start on something so huge.
So stick around, there's more from Lucy Whitehouse on the way in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, thank you so much for giving us a listen. My name is Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine. If you've heard the show before and you like what we do, if it's given you some help with your work, if you've enjoyed the top tips we've had from the writers over the last, 60 episodes or so, or if you are new to the show, if you've only just started listening because you saw our recommendation, fantastic, in Red Magazine. Did you see this? A national magazine listed us as one of the best book podcasts in the UK. Thank you so much to them for putting that out. If you've just found us because of that, or if you've been with us for a while, I'd really love for you to leave Writer's Routine a review over on Apple Podcasts. I promise it takes barely 2 seconds of your time. Just write a few words telling other people why you enjoy the show. Then they can find us through the podcast store, and it helps a load more budding writers get the help and the advice from some of the most successful ones out there. Now this week, we're talking about the writing routine of Lucy Whitehouse. She was born in Gloucestershire, she went to Oxford, and now she lives in Brooklyn. And you can imagine writing in Brooklyn, the vibrant energy that you just pick up walking around the city. And we hear why she needs that city, she needs the streets, she needs to leave the house to tell her story, and she needs to go to a women's only working space to get her words down. That really helps her out. And you can find out why during the chat. Now, her new book is Critical Incidents. It's the 5th book that she's published. It's based on D.I. Robin Osborne, who is going home, and her best friend Karina's family is engulfed by violence when she's there, and Robin has to get involved to make sure that the job is done right. And for Lucy, it marks quite a change for her. When I was sent an email by the publisher to say, do you want to interview Lucy? She's just made the move to procedural crime writing, and I didn't really understand what a shift that was. But I think amongst thriller and crime authors in that community, it is quite nuanced. So this is a really big deal. You can hear more about it in just a sec and find out why writing procedural crime is pretty different to writing psychological thrillers during our chat. Also, you can hear about how the very first idea for this book appeared to her almost out of nowhere. Like the flash of a light bulb, it just clicked on inside her mind. I know that's probably the case for pretty much all stories. Most of the ideas that we have come from nowhere. But for Lucy, it was a little bit different in that the whole thing came almost fully formed. She knew almost every aspect about her protagonist without really being made aware that she was even thinking of it. You can find out how that works in a little bit as well. And you can also hear how her writing routine has changed over 5 books. We'll also get a top writing tip from a rom-com author in the middle. I'll also read out some of your advice as well, so make sure you stick around for that. First, let's get into it with Lucy Whitehouse, starting, as always, with what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
That has recently changed. Until last year, I was working at a brilliant women's writing collective in Brooklyn, which was in a kind of semi-derelict building. The writer's space was called Powder Keg, and the room was an old loft space in an old bank. And we all had our own desk. Nothing matched. There were wires hanging from the ceiling. For 3 months last year, we didn't have running water, but we did have a full-size wooden model horse, Mexican, and a Chinese dragon's head, and lots of, we had disemboweled Wurlitzer jukeboxes and all sorts of things. But then we lost our water supply, so I had to move. But I am now incredibly spoilt because my writer's space is the writer's studio at the New Center for Fiction in Brooklyn, which I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend people visit when they're next in town. The Center for Fiction is exactly what it sounds like. It's the most beautiful new fiction collection, and they have a dedicated writer's space with 20 desks in. And It's the complete opposite of the Chinese dragon's head and the electrical threat.
Well, that opens up two things for me. Firstly, a woman-specific writing space. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very conscious that I'm asking you this as a white man, but why a women-only writing space, and what energy did that bring to your storytelling, do you think?
Women's only. The two founders, Holly and Sharon. Sharon is a news journalist, and Holly's a documentary maker. They founded it to have somewhere to work when they could no longer work at home, when they had children, and it grew from that. And I think they just kept it that way because they found a nice group of women, and it's a very supportive place, and it kind of clears out the picking up time for school, which is, which tells you everything you need to know, really. But it was a very supportive, atmosphere, and lots of those women. There's some wonderful women in that space. Susan Choi, for example, whose new book Trust Exercise just come out, is wonderful. And Mira Jacob, Good Talk. They've worked there, so it's was a really great, energetic, supportive space, and lots of great friendships. And I think that it helped for me hugely to just have women who knew exactly what I was doing and had all the... I have a six-year-old daughter, and to have people who knew exactly the difficulty of trying to concentrate while also being a present mother was very useful to me at a time when I moved from the UK and was separated from, you know, my friends and family here. So it was personal and professional. It was great.
And, yeah, I mean, it's notable that you're out of the house at this point. I don't speak to too many authors who very rarely write out of the house. Most of them do 80% of their work at home. It's half the benefit of being an author. Why don't you stay at home? Why do you feel the need to go out?
I like to go out because otherwise, well, it helps me have a kind of more balanced life. Otherwise, I think the temptation when you're at home is to feel like all the domestic things that you have to do get in the way. So I should just put a load of laundry on. What are we going to have for dinner? And, you know, when you have a kind of more traditional job, you don't have to think about those things, as you go to your office and that's it. And that really helps with the mental division between the two, just being physically removed from that sphere. Also, I mean, I'm quite a sociable person, and though I really need to be on my own to write, I do also like to come out and chat, and it's nice to have I mean, I think the Centre for Fiction is ideal for that because nobody talks in the writer's space, but there's camaraderie at lunchtime. So when you're having your lunch, you can have that little bit of social interaction, and there is zero possibility of writing in your pyjamas, which which I do not do anyway, because I am somebody who can sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning to write and then find that it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you know, I just don't like being in my pyjamas at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So
it sounds like this process, the way you write at the moment, has almost been learned through years, through novels. Tell me about the moment, if you can, that you realised that you probably couldn't stay working in a house anymore. You would need to go outside. What was it? What was that tipping point that made you need to leave the home?
Two things. The first was when I moved from England to America. My husband's a writer too. He's a screenwriter. And there, when we first moved, we were both used to working in our own spaces, and suddenly there were two of us there, and it that felt strange because we both like the private mental space to write, and we share work quite a lot with each other. We read each other's work, and we have kind of different strengths, so it's a very useful thing. But it did feel incredibly isolating when I first moved to America, to just be in a house with one person and also be married to that person. Very claustrophobic. I just needed to be out. So that was a contributory factor. And then also when my daughter was little, you know, she needed the house, and I quite liked going out and having some kind of adult time. Now she's six, so it's different. She's at school. But definitely writing's very personal, and you just need a sense of, you know, the room of your own is a big thing.
You spoke about not wanting to be in your pyjamas at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Do you find that, you know, getting dressed up for work, heading out for work, does that help you tell your story? Does it allow you to possibly get down to brass tacks a lot more than lounging around in your pyjamas would do?
I don't know. Certainly think it's mentally healthy. It really depends. On the rare occasions now, I mean always before, but on the rare occasions now where I just have uninterrupted days, you know, the time becomes very fluid. And if I'm really writing hard and into it, then, you know, days vanish, and they're a lot less structured. But it's, you know, having a smallish child, you have to be quite structured. And I think that's something that I found really fascinating at the women's writer space, is that people doing really excellent work in business hours. So there's none of the kind of romance of, you know, up late with a bottle of wine and kind of semi-nocturnal kind of lifestyle. It's like, no, I have from 9 till 2, and that is when I'm working today. And the work is just as good. There's two versions. There's the structured, and then there's the, I have 2 days uninterrupted. The day-to-day versions, American schools start quite early. So my daughter's on the school bus by 7:45. And then I am up and at the writer's space by 9, having done a few sort of practical organisational things beforehand. And then I do my social media looking and try not to fall down a news rabbit hole, which is really difficult in the age of Trump, I have to say. So I find news quite all-absorbing with Trump and Brexit.
I find it the reverse of you. As in, I find it really easy to not be dragged down a news wormhole because I just don't go near it. Because it's just so bleak that it's just so easy for me. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
Yes, with I have found that too. In the last few weeks, since the summary of the Mueller report was released, where I've just had I can't. but yes, so at work, I usually start by rereading what I wrote the day before, making some small edits, and that gets me back in the groove. And I try to write sort of always aim for 1,000 words a day. I find my comfort level when I'm really in the groove is about 1,200 words.
Envious cries from writers all over the world listening
yes,
to this.
12,000 words. 1,200 words. I read somebody the other day saying they wrote 6,000 words in a day. I've never done that. But I am finickety for sure. I edit a lot. I'm sure there's lots of, certainly my editor and agent wish that I wrote faster, but I'm afraid this is it. So yes, I try to be disciplined about eating lunch, but I quite often find that my best working hours are between 11 and 2. And then after that, I have a very late lunch and mess up dinner schedules. And
why do you think that is 11 and 2? Why do you think that's when you're most productive?
I don't know. I think it's because the brain is awake, properly awake by 11. I have found, actually, and I don't know whether it's practical just because I have to these days or because, your body and brain change as you get older. So I'm now 43. It used to be that I was much more of an afternoon and night person, but now I find sort of, if I can be at work and working by 9:30, I can get a lot done by 2. I can think that is a sort of full creative day's work by 2, which is it's fascinating. I'm very interested in this question of how all the kind of rules you make for yourself when you have no rules can easily be broken when you have to do them.
Did you find in your time at work and then in those three really concentrated hours from 11 till 2, are you working in fits, in bursts, in starts, or are you just ploughing through, getting as much done as you can?
It depends. On an ideal day when I have pure concentration, then I just write for 3 hours and just keep going, barely stand up, sometimes make a cup of coffee. Generally, if I'm really into it, particularly if I'm writing dialogue and it's like watching a tennis match, and kind of in it and hearing the dialogue, then I try not to break it. A friend of mine, Katie Darby, who's a wonderful writer, she writes excellent short stories, and she sometimes says that she has to write a short story all in one go. Because it's like a one night stand that you can't come back to it. It's not the same, the bubble has burst, which I've always loved that. And I do find that if I'm writing a scene, if I can get that flow, then I try not to break it.
That the phrase listening to the dialogue, mm-hmm. like you're almost a fly on the wall, you're a bystander to that conversation. That's fascinating. I've never heard that on this before. Mm-hmm. So you finish work about 2 o'clock.
I stop for lunch about 2. 2 days a week, I have to stop by 3:30, and the other 3 days a week I work till 5.
When you've finished at 5 or 2:30, is that it for the day, or do you find yourself going back perhaps at night to make little tweaks? Is it always churning over in your head?
It's always churning, and also because my husband's a writer, we quite often talk. So what were you doing today? So I've got this plot issue. What do you think about X? So we have kind of story conference in the kitchen when we're making dinner quite often, which is a treat. But yes, it's my stories are always just in my head constantly. And I do find that when I'm really in the flow of something, everything that I see around becomes relevant. It's like living in a hyper alert, hypersensitive state that I don't know whether it's because the brain is tuned in or because there's some kind of benign energy in the world, which I don't really believe, but it feels like that sometimes, that you hit a kind of creative groove and it's things arrange themselves to help you, and that's when you write the good stuff. I quite often find that the stuff that I wrote in a kind of almost kind of unconscious way, if I have one of these 3 or 4 hour stints where I don't stand up even to make a cup of coffee, often stuff comes that I didn't know was going to come. and it's often the best stuff that doesn't need editing. And I was constantly in search of that wavelength. My old workspace, I had my own desk, and so I had things on there that, you know, I brought in and accumulated, and it got messier and messier as deadline drew nearer, stacks of paper. But at the Centre for Fiction, it's hot desking, so you just have whichever desk you you choose out of the ones that are free by the time you arrive. And that's a very interesting thing, because I thought I would hate it, but actually I don't. It's very, it feels very clean, that you go and you start with a clean desk, which is not an experience that I've ever had before. So I actually quite like that. But I'm a big notebook user, so that's like my portable environment that, you know, I can dive into my notebooks.
Well, if I were to dive into your notebook, what would I see? Is it just a scattergun approach to ideas, random words placed here and there? Is there any logic to it?
There's no logic. It's I have two notebooks. I have one for one kind of working notebook where I sometimes find that writing by hand, if I'm stuck or struggling to work out something, I quite often write by hand, and that seems to access a different part of the brain. And I found that a really useful technique. But I also have a sort of more general ideas book, which is little things that occur to me here and there, or something I see, or also things I've cut out of newspapers, and things I've collected. Just interesting things, strange. There's no real kind of logic to it. Just I read a brilliant thing in Deborah Levy's, it's not The Cost of Living, the first one of her trilogy of living autobiographies. And she refers to her writer's notebook as like a police detective, so like making notes on a case, but she doesn't know even what the case is. And she says that years later she went back to the notebook and realised that she'd been collecting notes for a novel that she'd written in between. And I thought, yes, that is exactly right, because I went back to one of my old notebooks that I unpacked a box that I hadn't looked in for a while, and it was like being transported back into my head at the time that I'd written before we met, which was my book Before Last. So it's fascinating. I love that kind of, in the police detective's notebook. Yeah.
So aside from the notebook, let's talk about planning then and plotting. Does it exist in a formal way? Is there a physical version of your plan, or is it just all in your head? Are you using something on your laptop maybe?
I don't use any programs. When I wrote my first book, I didn't plot at all. I started with a very kind of loose idea of an atmosphere and a house and three characters. And then I started writing because I was just fed up with my own prevarication. So I bought a bottle of dessert wine, locked myself in the garden and said, you can't come in until you have three pages. And they were terrible, but I didn't allow myself to stop until I'd written 30,000 words, because that felt like so much that it would be psychologically painful to put that in the bin. And that was a way to get myself over the hurdle of how do I start on something so huge. But then that book evolved over the course of 6 years, where I was writing and cutting and chipping. It felt a bit like sculpture in a way, that you were just chipping. I knew there was something in there, but it was a very inefficient way of finding out what it was. But these days I do plot, and I think that's partly being more professional and learning that to write the kind of intricate books that I want to write, you know, pre-planning is just it's really, really helpful. I think when I started writing, I wrote thinking I wanted kind of, this is the story that I want to tell. And now when I write, I think this is the experience that I would like my readers to have. And it's a different mindset, but I want to design.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A book that feels thrilling and surprising and intricately structured, because I really admire people who do that well, and it is really satisfying. So that is what I'm aiming for, and so I do plot.
How thorough is the plotting then? If I were to see your plot, what would it look like? Is there bullet points for every chapter? You know exactly where your tale is going?
Yes and no. I started plotting by really because when I met my husband, and because he's a screenwriter, he was always talking about, he talks about structure in a very kind of formal way, and that was one of the first things we talked about when we were out. The first few times we talked about story structures, the nerdiest nerds. it was fantastic. But then you say, oh yeah, the end of act one and breaks and tent poles, and I was like, what is this jargon that you're talking? Whereas for me, I stories felt organic when I started writing, that you just kind of intrinsically knew through years of reading, and perhaps something kind of just deeply embedded and human, about what feels like a satisfying story, you know, where things have to happen, how things feel intrinsically balanced. But really, storytelling for screen is just a mapping of that. And if you try and write a story in a different way, it does fall back to that structure quite often. And I found it helpful to think about that in a conscious way, rather than sort of just relying on my instinct to go. But to answer your question, I start by drawing a graph. Sid Field, the writer of screenplay, has the three-act structure with the central tentpole of the big event at the middle, and I have my story in my mind, and I see if it roughly corresponds to that. So I know, it's a bit like putting a tent up, that you have the right structure, and then you're free within that to be creative, knowing that, you know, you're probably not going to write yourself off down a complete dead end and waste months and months of work, or just suddenly find a character, you know, going rogue, which has happened to me in the past. And I think you have to allow them to go rogue, because you know your characters much better when you finish than when you start. So it's a mixture. But after I've done the kind of rough kind of series of events, then I write a sort of a narrative summary for myself of, I mean, sometimes quite detailed, but it's not set in stone. It's more of a guide than a kind of prescriptive order.
On a practical level, when you turn up at your workspace every mm-hmm. morning, how do you know what you're working on that day?
I know where I left off the day before, and I do the little bit of editing, as I mentioned. But I've generally been thinking about it overnight, thinking about what's coming next, and so kind of rehearsing the conversations in my head a little bit, and thinking about locations, and so I don't think my brain ever really switches off from it. So it's just start by reading the last bit, and then try and find the flow, and hope for the best.
I'd love your writing tip, by the way. I know the show is mainly dedicated to advice from the most successful writers that I can find, and that could be you. If you've got a bit of advice that has really helped you get through the day, if you've got a little tip, a little trick that really helps get your stories out and iron them down onto paper, I'd love to hear it. You can let me know what it is and I will share it on the show. Tell me at writersroutine.com. That's what Mark in Manchester has done. Nice bit of alliteration in your name there, Mark. Write every day, that's what he says. It helps if it's at the same time every day, because then you get into the habit. But just make sure that you write every day, no matter what it is. Get it out there, get your story told, make it part of your routine. I mean, Mark, you could kind of distill the last, 2 years of my life doing this show and the last 60 episodes of our podcast into that very simple, quick line. Make writing every day part of your routine. I don't know if that's helpful or not. Thank you anyway, Mark. Also to Cleo, who is hot desking over in Milan. Brilliant. Nice way to get your work done, travelling around the world. Cleo says, edit as you go, because you find that you pick up tropes and ticks that you have as you write, and it helps you tell your story cleaner and get your ideas onto the page leaner. I completely understand that, Cleo. Make sure you cut and trim the fat as you're working, so you're constantly learning and you can make your story the best it can be, really, by the time you finish telling it. Cleo, Mark, thank you so much for your tips. If you've got a little bit of writing advice that's really helped the way that you get your stories down, I'd love to hear about it, and I'd really want to tell it on the show.
Hi, I'm Vari McFarlane. My book is Don't You Forget About Me. And my tip is, I'm kind of sharing this tip a little bit with Joss Whedon, because I read that he once said it, but I found it so true. If you've got scenes in whatever you're writing, be it a book or a script, and they're scenes you particularly look forward to writing, just crack on and write them. I think he used the analogy of you don't have to save your dessert till last. If you feel fired up to write something, don't tell yourself you have to start chronologically and hack through. Get something that's really inspiring you written and down, and then you can always move back and start at the beginning after that.
Now, if you missed Vari last week and you want to hear more tips from her and learn loads about her brand new rom-com book, Don't You Forget About Me, you can. She's got some pretty biting views over what makes a rom-com novel, what needs to be in something to make it funny, and also why we need to be more honest about how contrived storytelling really has to be. You can hear all that, you can catch up with the show. We've got 60 of them there that you can listen to, and that's where you can send me your writing tip as well. Get to writersroutine.com. Let's get back to it then, talking to Lucy Whitehouse. In this half of the chat, we talk about procedural crime, how it's different from psychological thriller, and the process of getting an idea like that down onto the paper and having to tie up all the loose threads. Because when you're writing procedural crime, it has to be full of that, really. Procedure. You need to make sure that you get everything right. That if a crime is committed, if it's going to be investigated by the police, the way it's investigated really needs to be accurate to lend your ideas and your creativity really any credence. We also talk about how much she knows her characters and the fact that she's just started writing a brand new series. What more she's got left to find out about them. How much there is a grey area, how much she voluntarily didn't find out the whole package, everything about her character, because she wanted some stuff to work with along the way. And we pick things up talking about her brand new book, It's Critical Incidents, and the very first idea that she had for it.
This was a strange one, because this, for me, is a slight departure, because my first four books were psychological suspense, and this is more literary crime.
Well, very quickly before you carry on, when I was having a discussion with your publisher, and one of the questions that he kind of pushed to me, he said, well, you know, Lucy has worked in psychological thriller, now this is more procedural. How big of that is a change for those who maybe aren't familiar with crime as a genre?
How drastic is that a shift? Both in terms of reading and writing.
I think if you enjoyed my previous books, you would enjoy this one too, because there's definitely a large overlap. And my investigative character, Robin Lyons, in this, she at the in book one, she has been fired by the Met, and so is working as a private investigator back in her hometown of Birmingham. So she's not within a traditional police structure, although she brings her skills of 15 years experience to bear on that. But a lot of what happens in the book is personal too. So I would say it's halfway between the two. In the second book of the trilogy, she is a police officer again. In terms of the writing, I think the difference is that this book is a lot less claustrophobic somehow. I think with psychological suspense, a lot of the reading and the writing of it is fear, and the sense of kind of encroaching dread. And that is not in this book. The reason for the shift, so I wanted to write something that felt broader. I wanted to talk more about issues that I think about all time in my daily life. It is personal for sure, but there's also issues in here of racism and poverty, and these are things that I wanted to think and write about. And those aren't necessarily things that would be so much or would be so easy to explore in psychological suspense, which tend to be more domestic and personal, I think.
So you had that idea, this is what I want to do. Mm. Then how did that translate into the formation of a plot? What was the very first essence of this actual story rather than just the ideas of your intention?
It was a very strange genesis for this book. Normally, I've started off with an atmosphere and characters and a place. With this one, I have a friend who works in TV, and she said to me, do you have an idea for a recurring central investigative female character? And I said, yes, I really want to write a book about a woman who is a detective in London, gets fired and moves back to her hometown of Birmingham. And it came out of my mouth I had no awareness that I'd ever had that thought.
So you're saying I've always wanted this, but you had no idea
that
you had
that? No idea. And I think that the Birmingham part of it came because in 2014, which was the year before I was asked this question, my father died. And he was born in Birmingham and had a small family engineering business that you can trace back in Birmingham since Victorian times. We've got adverts from, but my family's since moved slightly out of Birmingham, and he was the great kind of keeper of the kind of Birmingham history side of our family. And with him going, I felt like it was slipping away, and I suddenly thought, here's my subconscious saying, don't lose sight of this. This is where you come from. Go back and investigate. And it's pretty much what she does in the book. She goes back. She thinks she has memories of growing up in Birmingham, and has kind of one kind of set of views about it, and then goes back as an adult and finds that it's a totally different city, and that she'd been wrong. But it was the kind of interweaving of place and person is kind of one of my huge preoccupations in my writing, and I think that's where this one came from.
So you've got this notion that you didn't have any idea that you had, that you want to write about a female detective who's just been fired. She goes back home. Then what happens as a writer? Then what do you do? You've got that little elevator pitch. How does that then become a 400-page novel?
Well, slowly is the answer to that. It comes slowly. I sit down and I think about the story I want to tell and a story that would be interesting to read. And the things that interest me, and it's quite often going back to the idea of a detective's notebook, you know, I see themes in the ideas that I've been collecting, and I know that, you know, this is something I want to talk about. And I think in the case of this book, the fact that my father died and the business, the family business that we've had for a while, it's now run by my cousins. One of the ideas of the book is what happens when a family business that's been going for generations suddenly goes bankrupt, and what does that mean in terms of the fallout for that family? And happily, that has not happened to our family business. My cousins are doing a good job, but it was an interesting idea. So that was one strand that went in. I'm always fascinated in relationships about trust and how much you know and how much you can ever trust anybody. It's obviously a big question of psychological suspense, but it's also about knowing people but then finding something unknowable or unknown about them. That fascinates me too. I think part of it, one of the very important characters in this book is Robin's daughter. She's a single mother and her daughter's now 13. And I, having a daughter of my own, that relationship has completely transfigured the way that I think of the world. I mean, it's not too extreme to say it's really added another dimension to my understanding of things. And I wanted to write about that, but coming with the idea of my main character's relationship with her daughter is also her relationship with her mother. There's three generations of women, friends and family in this book. And it's a lot of it was exploring that. So all these things, practically, it takes a really long time. But the book I'm writing now, which is the second one in this trilogy, is much easier from the point of view of knowing I have the broad arc in my mind when I started writing it, and I have a lot of the characters, though not all. And so that helps, but it takes a really long time. I think of it as a kind of layering up of ideas and collecting. It's almost like I have a big box and I'm just kind of collecting things that go in there, and gradually, you know, gradually the thing emerges. But there's always two or three moments in the course of a book where I think, oh yes. It's normally when I get really stuck and I think, oh my God, what have I done? I've just written myself down a blind alley, and then, you know, I have about 5 or 6 days of being extremely fractious and hard to live with, and then I'll be just walking down the street and go, oh, that's the answer, and it kind of pivots the book. One of the things I am particularly enjoying about this process is that I know her very deeply, but she doesn't know herself that well. So she is kind of discovering herself as she goes along. I think it's almost as if she's been so busy for the last 13 years since she had her daughter that she's not a very emotionally self-aware person, and she gets people wrong all the time. And over the course of this trilogy, she kind of learns to read people better and to accept other people and to accept herself as well. So that's the kind of emotional and intellectual journey for her in this book, and that's fun to write because I know her very well, but I'm kind of writing her into an understanding of herself.
Making the move to procedural police crime, there are certain plot points that I would imagine you need to hit as an author for fans of crime and thrillers as a genre. They expect certain things to be in a book. How much did that influence your telling of this story, knowing what almost needed to be in there?
Shockingly, not very much. I think because I'm a big crime reader and crime watcher, those things are kind of intrinsically kind of in my understanding of what makes a satisfying crime novel. But I didn't consciously think about what needed to be in there in terms of kind of what the genre expects. I just thought about what would make a satisfying crime story. That sounds perhaps a little naive, but that was my thinking. I knew some of the writers whose plotting I really admire. I mean, Jo Nesbø, for example, he's an extraordinary plotter, just amazing. And I'm reading Harry Potter to my daughter at the moment, and I really take my hat off to J.K. Rowling too. The plotting is so web-like and intricate, it's fantastic. And I wanted to be able to structure something that was as satisfying on a crime level as those. But so I did plot the crimes and the interweaving of the strands very carefully. But yes, perhaps I need to think more about genre. But I didn't want to write a purely genre book, so I didn't set off with a purely genre framework in mind. It's kind of an awkward crossbreed.
So, how many? Five novels in now? Mm. Five novels in. I usually ask this question to authors who are 30 novels in.
Yeah.
How much has your process and the way you tell stories changed since your first novel?
A lot, I think. I think when I started writing, I just went by instinct. Now I can combine that with a much more structured intellectual approach to it. And as I said, I think about, you know, what would make a really satisfying story and concentrate on. I always have the reader now foremost in my mind, whereas before, I think when I started, I had an idea of how you told a story. I think just the level, having spent, I dread to think how long now, 15, 16, 17 years doing it, your craft and skill levels improve. And the more I go on with writing, the more I come to an appreciation of how much of it is about leaving things out as much as putting them in. And that is that's a kind of a skill that I have definitely got much, much better at. My book's getting shorter and shorter, actually. This is so I'm obviously, I will get to the point soon where I'll be a word per chapter. But no, it is true. And I think that one of the things that I've learned is kind of trusting readers to kind of imply and get it, and I love it when other writers do that. Just kind of trust your reader to read between the lines. It's really satisfying reading, and that's something that I'm aiming at.
That's it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Lucy Whitehouse for sparing the time to chat to me while she was over here from Brooklyn. You can learn loads more about her new book and get more tips from other writers right now on our website. It's writersroutine.com. Now, next week, we're chatting to an international best-selling writer, sold millions of copies all around the world, another author that I managed to spend some time with while he was over from America. You can hear from Jeffrey Deaver next week on the show. We'll talk about his brand new book, The Never Game. Now, if you've enjoyed the show, if you'd like other aspiring writers to get the help and advice from our authors just like you have, please do leave a review for the show over on Apple Podcasts. That'll help other people find us. Also, subscribe to us if you're on there, and please do subscribe however you listen to the show, if that's Google, if it's Spotify. That will just really help people that need our help find our help. You can also give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram. It's WritersPod on Twitter, and we're WritersRoutine on Instagram. Then you'll get pretty much daily motivational quotes and insights that I've managed to piece and jazz together from some of the favourite authors that we've had on the show. Yes, I will see you next week, where we'll have international bestseller Jeffrey Deaver on the show. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.